whiskey, gin, and brandy. With the glass, I'm pretty handy. So join me for a drink, boys.
Welcome to the Barfly Podcast Season 5. My name is Jeff Brokart, Barfly columnist for the Bay Area News Group, and author of the books 20 Years Behind Bars, The Spirit of the Adventures of a Real Bartender, and its sequel, Parole Denied. My co-host and barback is Kevin Blum, editor of The Marin Dish. Sit back and relax as we attempt to pull back the curtain on the hospitality industry, and feel free to pour yourself a beverage. I know Kevin and I will.
Welcome back to the Barfly Podcast. We are very excited to have Kevin Cavry and Chef Sylvain Montassier from Paseo, a California bistro, on the program. Paseo, which is arguably one of Marin County's most romantic restaurants, is currently celebrating the 75th anniversary of its historic landmark in Mill Valley. So welcome and bienvenue to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Well, let's discuss the 75th anniversary. The restaurant has obviously seen many incarnations over the years in this beautiful property. What do you think is it about this place that resonates with people and that has resonated for so many years and made it such an institution?
I think the charm of the restaurant by itself, you know, like being around for 75 years already, that's kind of like an achievement by itself in an economy, you know, when like things come and go, you know, like being part of a community keeps something alive like that for so long, you know. I think that's like already like very remarkable by itself. I think the setting is really unique. Mill Valley is kind of like that old charming town, and having like a brick building, you know, which is probably like something they don't really build anymore for like earthquake, you know, whatever they do. So having like something that kind of unique, yeah, it's just pretty good, and it's nice, and we can contribute to like keeping it going.
I think there's a top end for this space that you don't often see in restaurants, and that's true both from the staff's perspective as well as the guest perspective. Different places I've worked may have had their charms, but you're like, well, the building, the inside's beautiful, the interior is beautiful, but God, I hate the parking lot, or, you know, there's always something off. But you walk in here and there's no part of it that isn't just gorgeous, epic, feels world class.
Yeah, it's like as soon as people walk in, like in the Paseo, in the walkway, it's like, oh, they're like in Europe, or like, could be in Italy, I could be in France, I could be like, it's very unique. It's kind of like you're entering like a very unique little world. But like Kevin was saying, you know, like a restaurant can have like maybe a nice like decor inside, but I think this is just charming because I think it was made out of like genuineness, you know. It was just made to be nice. There was no let's do like a business concept of making it look like Europe. It's just like the way it was built,
right. It's not forced, right?
It's not forced.
It's kind of naturally organic, if people want to make that, use that term.
The downtown's beautiful, the street's beautiful, the event space across the street's beautiful, the walkway. By the time they sit down, it's just all these like concentric circles that make you really feel like you're transported into something. And sometimes front of house in particular go to such crazy lengths to like manufacture that sense. And it just happens, like you're saying, like organically here. And we can really feel that with.
How long have you been now the executive chef?
Since like late February, like pretty much since like the reopening, like the post, there was like a little gap like at the beginning of 2023. So I joined late February and we reopened like officially like March 7, I believe. Yes.
And what was your vision for the cuisine? I mean, obviously, like I said, this Paseo has had so many different owners over the years and different chefs. What was your vision when you came in here?
Well, I think it was kind of like a good match. I think they wanted like something a little bit more down to earth, like something like that like customer can relate to, whether it's ingredient you use, but also in a world where you get something so deconstructed or something you don't know what you're eating, you know, like just like having like which also at the stage where I am right now in my cooking, very much to showcase ingredients and people see what they're eating and they know what they're eating. You know, we prep it the right way when we try to make it delicious. So that was kind of like what they wanted to go toward, and that's very much what I'm about right now. So it was kind of like the connection happened like really quickly, you know. And now, you know, like we're like full steam. We work with a lot of farms. I go to the farmers market every week to pick up like most of our produce. So our menu is very seasonal. It drives people crazy, but we change the menu a lot, you know, like, because like, we always reprinting.
Well, it keeps you on your toes in the kitchen.
Yes, it sure does.
What one dish would you say kind of encapsulate right on the menu right now that would encapsulate exactly what you're talking about right there?
Maybe I would like to talk about the one that are not on the menu yet, sure. But you know, like just getting excited, like we're about to do like a wild sea bass with like some fresh Italian butter beans. You know, I love like fresh shelling beans when they're not dry, because you can really like cook them like more precisely, and they don't get that either undercooked or mushy kind of texture. We just picked up fava beans. Those are kind of like summer peppers are in season, so we're gonna do all kind of like dishes like this week, like coming up with like those new ingredients. So I'm the kind of guy, like after a while, you know, I just wanted to do something else, you know, that kind of like excites. It's like new prep day, kind of like everybody has like a different task, you know, in the kitchen. So I'm really excited about the sea bass like coming up. It's gonna be like really fun.
How soon is that coming up?
Probably this week. Got the shelling beans in house, we got the fava beans, so it's really like we're picking up a lot of business. Things have been really like trending upwards. You want to do it tomorrow, but like this week for sure, like it's gonna happen this week. More like on the business side, you don't want just to change everything, you're left with whatever you're not using anymore, you know. So it's got to be kind of like a smooth transition where you're kind of like running out of what you have the next day, like you're starting the new dish. So there is like a little bit of winding things down and then like get ready for the new stuff.
People forget there's a business plan involved.
That's right.
You have to use up the product that you bought.
100%.
You don't want to just throw it all out just because it's no longer in season.
Especially with that type of cooking that seem like simple on everything, you know, but you work with ingredients that are expensive. You can buy dry beans for like really cheap. You got to be like very careful, you know, like make sure like if you want to do that kind of cooking, you can't afford any waste. Like
in this day and age, telling someone you're out of something, they don't understand that sort of thing. But sometimes with fresh seasonal ingredients, you do run out because that's all you've got, and
that's
you want
right.
them at the peak. You don't want to serve the last tomatoes of the season. The business aspects of the restaurant business are always complicated because guests have one perception and the business people have a different perception.
Especially since COVID too, I felt like there was a juicy 18 months there where guest expectations were like, if you're open, thumbs up from us,
right.
We'll pay whatever it is. You know, you can forget the sauces and the side-ons.
They were more forgiving and accepting, right?
Yeah, and that's definitely tapering off. You know, people are getting back to their old tricks. So I think that there's a little bit of that, you know, I don't want to say like panic, but a little bit of that good anxiety in people that do what we do to kind of like gear up now that we had a little time where people were giving us the benefit of the doubt. And now we all need to get on our A game, even with there being a real dearth of qualified staff. It's going up and, you know, everything.
And the chain is so like supply chain, even if you work with something that grew 20 miles away from here, there is still seasons, things happening. Maybe the common person doesn't realize, you know, how the rain earlier in the season damaged a lot of crops. I work with a couple of farms in San Mateo County. A lot of early crop peas and things like that just got destroyed. Now you had to start again from scratch. So things are showing up a little bit later. So even something you think is going to be there. Sometimes it can just stop out of nowhere. So we really have to be flexible. But the guests, like Kevin was saying, like we have to relay that message. And sometimes, I don't know if everybody is very receptive to that message. And like tomorrow, it could be no tomato. You know?
and I also think that like farm to table became such an overused concept that it started to get watered down what it really
100%.
Meant.
Right.
And it's just kind of like, oh yeah, farm to table.
It's like
that,
a buzz phrase that everybody uses now.
Yeah,
whether
definitely.
It is or not, yeah.
Before Sauvin, you know, I had a couple of restaurants where, you know, just like us, it was on our business cards, locally sourced, naturally harvested, farm to table.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of chefs.
It's a marketing thing.
Literally was just something on the business card, and I did not see it behind closed doors. That was one of the reasons I wanted to work with him, is he's so passionate and caring about the whole supply chain, the farmers, the growing seasons, the very real Mother Nature defined aspects of this business. I'm constantly talking about that with the staff. It feels good to be the place that's actually doing that.
And you're right, there's a difference between talking the talk and walking the walk. You know, a lot of that happens nowadays where it's these little punch words. I want to say about the supply chain, that's something people don't want to hear anymore. No. There's something that they're tired of, right? It's okay, you know, explaining to me why you're having problems isn't gonna make them happy.
Yep.
Best not to have that conversation if you can get around it, right?
Possible.
And again, that's navigating the customer versus the business side of that.
I'm curious because, I mean, you brought up COVID, which God knows we've done enough podcasts and interviewed enough people about that during it, and now that we're on the better side of things. Like you said, when you sort of launched, unfortunately, in the midst of pandemic, and then there was also, in addition to that, the construction going on in the neighborhood, like on the streets, and how have you been going about reintroducing yourself to locals and immersing yourselves in the community?
We're lucky enough to work for a great young owner who's definitely capitalizing on new technologies and, you know, social media and things that aren't really in our wheelhouse. I kind of have the feeling that you and I would both prefer to be working in the 1900s or 1800s.
Those are the good old days.
Maybe going good farther days, back. Yeah. They grew good produce back then, too.
They did, yeah.
I've noticed that you do Wine Wednesdays. Yeah. And like with Thursdays, you do jazz?
Yeah, we have jazz music in the courtyard. I think that was one of my first perceptions. I wasn't really familiar with Mill Valley when I started working here. I was here a couple of months before Sylvan was. It's a really unique blend of our average customer is a real foodie. They've eaten at some of the best restaurants in San Francisco, which means they've eaten at some of the best restaurants in the country.
In the world.
In the world. They cook at home. They care about produce. They have a lot of knowledge. Most of it's right. So, you know, on two tables next to each other, you might have someone that is genuinely coming in expecting for a borderline kind of like on the tier of a Michelin or a James Beard level experience. And the table next to them is someone that rolled out of bed, hungover, and they're just coming for a cheeseburger. And, and so it's a really interesting blend. The locals are pretty darn casual for the most part. But then every once in a while, they'll have a business meeting in here, and it's just an entirely different vibe. So yeah. I think on our end, there's definitely some challenges, but it's also fun to kind of have those multiple worlds existing in your restaurant at a time. Fun, right?
Oh, yeah, fun for sure. But I see also the challenge. I don't want to say the burden. Because the place has been open for so long, there is probably a lot of people that know the name, you know, without like really knowing what we're about right now. So they kind of have a preconceived idea of what they're going to experience. Before us, it was like a steakhouse, I think, or something, you know, with like Taylor Florent. Before that, known to be that kind of classic French restaurant. So
classic German at one point.
Something like that, yes. So the place is loaded with like history. We gotta keep the identity, but yet also give it like a new layer. And I find it like a challenge because like everybody's like, oh yeah, I know Paseo, but you don't know us now.
Had you ever thought about rebranding? Like coming up with just a completely different name?
Yeah, that's a good question. You did keep the name. There's a lot of history involved in that, and obviously pinpoint a spot, and the idea that it's not, you know, some chrome and a white tile building now. It's still the same old thing. So was that conscious?
So neither one of us were there for those decisions. Yeah. So Sylvan is the second executive that we've had. So in the end of December, we kind of went through a transition phase. I think that the owners definitely thought about that. I think that one of their consultants even suggested that it probably made the most ultimate financial sense, so that was the best branding move. The Che's are locals, and I think after, you know, being a part of this community, having a lot of communications with our neighbors, I think there was a sense that the community didn't want that. Mm-hmm. That they're used to this place going through multiple different menus, evolutions over the time, but that, you know, all the restaurants have chosen to keep Paseo as part of the name. We do have this gorgeous walkway, and I think that they more wanted to make like an exclamation point in an ongoing, evolving, iconic space, as opposed to come in and just say, well, like, because we spent some money, now we're going to rewrite over all of this history and maybe have something garish in a billboard out front that the neighbors didn't like.
Is it a better move to keep the name, get rid of the name, you know, because you can have like a strong argument for either decisions.
And I think we're still a reflection of the community. Those iterations of this place where it was more of a formal French or not really foodie or not really modern, you know what every dish was going to look like. I think that fit the demographic of Marin, which tended to be older school, kind of the fun stuff's going on in East Bay and San Francisco.
The things have shifted now, haven't
but
they?
But yeah, there's a ton of young tech people coming from the city and moving here. We meet people all the time in their 30s and 40s that just bought a house in the community. They want more of this style, more of his adventurous, playful fusion, you know, elements. So
I'm glad they kept the name.
Me too.
It's because you kept the decor, because you kept the charm.
You want that continuity. You want to continue. That's not a bad
thing. And as to go back to even to what I was saying earlier, like everything changed and everything is like a part of something that lasts. It's got like legacy, you know, like I think it's kind of nice to
be a part of that legacy for sure.
But like when I was young and I first moved to the Bay Area, like I came to this place. I mean, I never really lived in Marin until now, you know, but like I came to Paseo like maybe like 20 years ago. And I've never came since, you know, but yet, you know, when I got introduced through a common friend told me like, hey, you know, Paseo is in need of a chef. I knew right away. I didn't need to look for it. I knew where I was.
Can you talk a little bit more about your wine and cocktail program and how you tie that in with your food? Been here a few times in the evening, and especially in the bar, it's a great place to sit, whether you're on a date or just very casual with friends. But you have a fairly sophisticated cocktail program and wine program.
Beautiful wine cellar, too. And, I mean, that's spectacular just to look at.
So I was lucky enough to inherit some amazing wine when we started. We also just brought a full-time sommelier on the staff as well, Christopher Martinez. He's owned his own French restaurant and had his own import business, so he's adding a more traditional, classic approach, I'd say, to our wine program, which is really nice. I'm so hyper-focused on California that, you know, I was really only working with wine producers in a couple of counties here. He's bringing in some amazing French wine, and I think really has developed that program. My background is in craft cocktails. We opened the first craft cocktail bar in Marin, Tavern on 4th, about like a year before California Gold came in and really perfected the model. And I've been lucky enough to stage or work at some real world class programs. So I would say that the craft cocktail program we had was something that the locals in this town were absolutely wanting and not really getting. So there was a couple of places that had craft cocktail menus, but you know, when I showed up, I heard that it was a lot of drinks that description looked good, and then it all tasted like a margarita of some sort. I think we've all been to cocktail menus that are like that. Yeah. Two parts alcohol, one part sugar, one part citrus. Mm. We're just gonna make them different colors and kind of go from there. So I think like Chef, I try to use a lot of like local produce. We definitely have a produce-driven cocktail program. My personal philosophy when it comes to spirits and wines is to kind of like break ourselves out of that echo chamber that can exist, especially like on Reddit and these places where we decide, you know, E.H. Taylor is like the one. And it's a fantastic whiskey, but I think that it kind of harms the alcohol industry as a whole when we can look up some list on Reddit and then we can all say this is the only thing that means quality, and then a lot of stuff gets kind of falls between the cracks. There was a period, I think, when I was like learning about spirits and wine where I wanted to find out what the It's on Sarah is right now, or what the best new single malt is. What gets me going now is like trying to find small distilleries, especially if they're here in California, bring products people aren't familiar with, new styles, new techniques. We've brought a lot of female and people of color owned products in, which still blows my mind in 2023, is not something that you hear in bar programs. You don't hear beverage directors like making a push for that. Like Benny Ashburn's Crown and Hops is a new San Diego-based brewery, black-owned, really awesome. I think we have the very, very first keg in the Bay Area, but that's like our house pilsner. Anna Romero's the only level 3 tequila maestra in the entire world, but she has an amazing reposado called Mi Gente. We brought that in, and it's in a lot of our signature cocktails. So, we definitely focus on those things as well.
A lot of it is monkey see, monkey do in the cocktail business. Oh, yeah. This is popular. You can have the Weller sitting next to the Pappy, and everyone wants the Pappy, 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 Pappy. And you say, well, you know, that's a wheated bourbon too, right?
Right.
It's right next to it, and it's a 1/10 the price.
Right.
But people don't want to do that. They want whatever's popular.
Well, not only it's a wheated bourbon, it's exactly the same thing too.
Yeah.
It's like well, it's 10.
The same mash bill. It's an identical mash bill.
Yeah.
Identical
well,
wood.
They go through each barrels, and
yeah.
one become well,
right.
and one become puppy.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
but like it's exactly the same juice.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's quite funny. Yeah.
But that's that point of where people, like you were saying earlier, where sometimes they know what they're talking about, and sometimes they
yeah.
just follow these trends. Because I always notice, you know, a drink comes around, I've never heard of it, and then all of a sudden you think, well, I'm gonna have to go and research that because I'm gonna be making those, so I've
right.
got to figure out what they are. But that's how the that business works. A little bit of information is dangerous.
In general, we can see with the whole industry too that like craft cocktails became this thing, and like even kind of breweries and kind of very like blue class places suddenly needed to have a cocktail menu on. And it was often somebody who just can barely use a knife that was making those recipes. The kitchen's not really interested in getting involved. So the need to have craft cocktails outstripped the actual expertise
yes.
and cooking technique and understanding like the molecular gastronomy of, you know, we're going to pull certain compounds out of something by making a shrub and, you know, using vinegar and thyme to extract flavor versus boiling something in a pot with sugar. Like that makes such a huge difference. You know, I can say from experience that like a lot of my bosses coming up through the bar industry had no knowledge whatsoever. So I think the other thing that we're seeing is like a lot of average bartenders that know how to ferment. You can actually give them stuff to study. They'll go home and like learn the science behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a very like educated, engaged bartender community right now. So it's a really fun time to be doing this stuff.
Well, raw egg's a great example of people
yeah.
on the bar not understanding
yeah.
what a problem that can be.
Sure.
Right? Where you think there's some cracked eggs that have been sitting on the bar for 6-7 hours,
yeah.
right? Who knows? And
what
now
could possibly go wrong?
Right? So that, again, that's that knowledge versus application and
yeah.
all that kind of thing. It's all got to kind of come together. That's the nice thing about this place is it's not so big that it would be unwieldy. How many servers do you have on the floor at a time? 3?
Yeah.
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 And you
four,
have one bartender. That's
yeah.
not a lot of staff to manage,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so that you can be a little more fine-tuned in picking those
yeah.
people, I would imagine.
And we've reached that threshold of like food nerdiness too, which I really appreciate, at least amongst the front of house. No one goes out to eat without sending a screenshot. And then it's just like an endless thread of debating menu choices and, well, this tasted like this. I wasn't expecting that. So that really shows that everyone's just like as engaged as the two of us are. And when you can get your staff to get on that level, it's just like amazing things can happen.
So don't worry about tomorrow. Take it for today.
Please join us next time where we welcome industry insiders and industry outsiders to talk about the state of the restaurant and bar business. My name is Jeff Burkhart. Thanks for listening.